Welcome to Better Words, a podcast for readers who want to know the stories behind the pages.
We're your hosts, Caitlin and Michelle, two book nerds who bring you in-depth conversations about writing and publishing from those on the inside.
Basically, we're just here to talk about books.
We're so glad you're joining us.
Hello, welcome back to Better Words.
Hello, Michelle. I want to hear all about your trip.
So I went to Berlin last week and we had a wonderful time. I feel like it's the first time we've done one of those like explore-y sort of holidays, you know, a place where we've never been before in like years, which is so fun. I mean, there are places in the UK we've never been before that we've done smaller trips to, but I feel like, you know, it was the whole going for a week, getting to the airport, you know, like it felt a bit different. So we just had an amazing time.
Something about an airport makes it feel like a proper holiday.
A proper holiday. Yeah, exactly. You know, really nice hotel and stuff. It was really lovely. I love Germany now. Like it's just so easy to get around and everything was very efficient, of course. Yeah, I have been learning German on Duolingo as well, which I'm loving. So I felt like, even though I was too nervous to have like use anything in conversations apart from like danke, which is thank you, it made me feel a little bit less nervous to know that, like, from, you know, reading signs and stuff like that, I was like, oh, I recognize that, you know, it wasn't quite so daunting. I've always had a lot of anxiety around going to countries where English isn't the first language, even though, as everyone keeps saying, you know, every European country, they all speak English, you know, it's fine, don't worry. I think there's still that little bit of worry when, I don't know, it's just like I'm an anxious person anyway. So, of course, I'm going to feel a little bit nervous about that aspect that's like out of your control. But obviously, we were absolutely fine. English is like on every sign anyway. But I'm enjoying learning a language as well, like as a side note. It's really, really fun. I'm really enjoying that. And German's a really nice language to learn because a lot of it makes very logical sense from English. That as a side note.
Well, that's good.
It will not surprise you to know that we did a couple of museums. Jack and I both enjoy history things, so we did lots of that, and we didn't do much World War II stuff because we sort of felt like we'd done a couple of World War II museums and stuff in England. So I was really keen to learn about more like the Cold War stuff. So for anyone who maybe doesn't know, I don't want anyone to feel like I'm like dumbing everything down, that like maybe you don't. But obviously Berlin was divided into and Germany was divided into during the Cold War, with the eastern side being like the Soviet side and the western side being like the Allies, so like America, France, England, that sort of thing. And obviously there was the Berlin Wall, and that was part of that. So yeah, I was very keen to like learn about more Cold War stuff. So we did a museum called the DDR Museum, because the DDR, that's like the German, like Deutsche Democratic Republic, I think, which was the GDR in English, so German Democratic Republic. That is the name for like East Germany. So that museum was like super interactive. Like they had houses set up, or like kind of, you know, the room set up in a house that you could go and look at, and, you know, lots of stuff to go and look at to see what life was like.
I love a recreated house.
Oh, it was so cool. So like they had, but all the drawers and stuff you could open. And they, it was very interactive. They claim to be the world's most interactive museum. So it was very like lots of reading and stuff, but it was so interesting to see. So that was more about life in the GDR, which I just think is so interesting. And actually, one of my podcast recommendations in this month's Substack, which is obviously coming out at the end of the month, I'm going to recommend an episode of We Are History, which I think sums up a lot of some of the quirky, interesting things that we learnt at the museum. It's actually like one of the first episodes they did, and like regular readers of the newsletter will know that I recommend We Are History a lot, but this is one of the first ones.
Have you not gone back and listened to that?
No, I had, but it's probably like, I think I had, because, you know, I went through and listened to a lot of We Are History when I was building IKEA furniture in our house when we moved here. And I think I've listened to every episode, and then I've sort of picked the ones I think Jack will be interested in at times. And so it'd probably been ages since I'd listened to it. And when we were there, I was like, oh, they've done so many Cold War sort of things or German things. Like, let's pick ones to go back and listen to. And that was one that I was like, oh, I don't think you've listened to this. And if you have, it was ages ago. And we sort of went and re-listened to it. And it really sort of, yeah, summed up a lot of the kind of weird, cool things. And they reference a lot a book called Stasiland by Anna Funder, which I had started listening to before we left, but I wasn't loving the audiobook narration. So I will return to the book, but I'm going to read it. And that just had some really interesting stuff in it. So speaking of Stasi, which was the Soviet secret police, one of the other really cool museums we visited was the Stasi Museum. So the Stasi was like the KGB, the FBI, the CIA, all rolled into one. And they were insanely like embedded in everyday life, to the point where, you know, I think the ratio ended up being like one Stasi officer for every six people. Like, you've got to imagine a society where everybody is under surveillance all of the time, and they're under surveillance not just by official Stasi officers, but by their friends. They had over 180,000 unofficial informants. So yeah, your family members and your neighbors, everybody, like everybody was informing in a lot of different ways, whether they were coerced into it or not. We booked a guided tour of the Stasi Museum, and our tour guide really gave a lot of great context for sort of the paranoia that the GDR government was feeling and why they felt like they needed to control the population in this way. It was a very interesting mix of German bureaucracy meets Soviet sort of politics, and that's why this system in Germany in particular, like, is so, it's just like next level, like even more intensive than Russia's Soviet system and stuff like that, because of the German love of bureaucracy, basically, this guy was saying. But he was telling us this story about his friend who, you know, when he finally got access to his Stasi files after the fall of the Berlin Wall, he found out that, like, his dad had been an informant on him, and it just amazing, fascinating culturally. And Jack and I just kept saying, like, how do you change your mindset? Like, imagine living in the GDR or growing up in the GDR. How do you, when the wall comes down, just change? Like, that would muck you up so psychologically, being surveilled so much. Like, how do you rebuild from that? And we kept walking around being like, oh my god, there are people living in Berlin who would have lived in it. Like, it just, we couldn't get over it. I love social history stuff, so that was like fascinating. And I know that there are probably people listening being like, you sound so dumb.
Comprehend.
but
those things are like so hard to comprehend sometimes when it's obviously so different than our history and our upbringing and everything. Yeah. You just can't imagine
and like
how that
I
would have been.
Like, let's not lie, there are lots of problems with capitalism when taken to its most extremes, and there are elements of Soviet society that you think, that sounds good on paper. Obviously, I'm not saying that. I mean, for example, they had state childcare for everybody. The downside was that was because they had such a shortage of labor that they needed every available person to be working. In fact, it was a crime to be unemployed in East Germany. So yeah, it's just like the idea of some, they were really liberal with like allowing abortions and, access to birth control. And yet on the other side, like, you can't have free thought about the political structure. So yeah, it just made us think a lot about like just society and stuff. It was really interesting. And we've also started watching something that I don't know if it's on the Australian Netflix, but I'll link to it, called Turning Point. And it is about essentially how the bombing of Hiroshima at the end of World War II was the start of the Cold War. And it sort of really explains, I mean, I wish this series had been around when I was doing modern history in year 12 and trying to understand specific conflicts of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Because I think they didn't do a big picture stuff like that for us when we were learning this. And it's a really interesting series that literally takes you through. I mean, we just watched the second episode last night and it literally is like, this is how communism started. This is where it goes wrong. You know, like this is the ideology versus. So it's very interesting if you're like,
sound interesting. I never did history in high school. So
I think you'd find it interesting just to be like, oh, now I get it. And I get what the, you know, the ideologies and the, because it also talks about like the search for communists in the US and like the Red Scare and all that sort of stuff. And I think it's just stuff that sometimes you hear referenced or you see and maybe you don't have a great understanding of it. And I did history at school and I still am like a bit confused by certain things or my knowledge is patchy, and it's a good sort of explainer of all of that. So that sort of all coincided with us also going to Berlin. Aside from the history stuff, we found a massive climbing gym to go to and we spent hours there and it was so much fun. It was insanely big. It was brilliant. Some really fun climbs. Never thought I would be a person who exercised on holiday, but there we are. And
I also saw you went to an insanely big bookshop.
I was literally going to say the best bookshop thing. I think maybe like an hour or so. It wasn't that long, to be fair. Like, I think it was pretty restrained. I think it's about 5 levels. Dustman Dusk Half House, which is the culture department store.
Oh my God, that's so good. Yeah. I love that.
So Dustman is the name of the thing, but yeah, I'm pretty sure Das Culture Kaufhaus is the culture department store. So they had like lots of audiobooks on CD and they had like a whole like DVD section as well. So it really was like everything. They have obviously like the majority of it is German. So I had so much fun going and looking at our previous guests and seeing what covers they had and like just picking out stuff of like, oh, this is an Aussie, like a Jane Harper, what's it called over here? Like, I just love that sort of stuff. It's so nerdy. And then they have a pretty big English speaking section as well for every, like for young adult, children's, adults. Like, they have a really large English bookshop as well. So I bought some books there. So yeah, this is where we get to the actual bookish part of today's episode. So I will say as well, I love trying to read something that is related to where I'm visiting. So before we left, I read Berlin Game by Len Deighton, which is like a modern classic. I didn't really realize who Len Deighton was until I started working here in the bookshop, but he's a very well-known sort of spy writer, sort of espionage novels, like kind of not like a pioneer of that, but very much of that time. They were written during the Cold War, I think, and like very much of that time. So Berlin Game is about who works for MI5 or MI6, one of them. And there are leaks basically coming from, they work out there's someone within their organization in East Germany who's been put over there, is someone in the organization is giving information to Russia. So he's trying to find out who that is. There's a great twist, which I did sort of see coming, but I really appreciate given when this was written as well, but it definitely has bits of like him actually sneaking into the East through a couple of specific stations which we went to just by chance. One, Nordbahnhof, used to be what they call a ghost station where Western trains would go pass through it, but they wouldn't stop, like no one would stop at that station, but it was essentially a place where East and West like crossed over because the train tracks ran so close to one another. So that's quite cool. When we went there, they have photos up of how it was boarded up for ages, and it was sort of a place where there could have been gaps in the wall essentially. So I enjoyed reading that and then like seeing it, and you know what, it actually was like, it wasn't my usual type of book, But I quite enjoyed it. It was very like dialogue heavy and it sort of moved fairly quickly. And I think reflecting on this and the next book I'm going to tell you about, you know, like we've sort of said we don't read many classics and I struggle with them. But maybe maybe the like Penguin modern classics is like the way that I can try and read more classics, because obviously they're more
broaden
like 20th
your,
century
our own definitions of classics.
Yeah, exactly. And like they're obviously more 20th century usually, and they're still really good writers. And I'm really, I don't know whether like I loved that book, Berlin Game, but I did enjoy it and I would be interested to read more Len Dighton. Like I was interested in how it sort of unfolded. Didn't always understand all of it, but I appreciated it. And like, maybe this is growth as a reader.
I'm witnessing it in real time.
Oh my God. and then the next one, which was recommended when I was like looking for books set in Berlin, was a book called Alone in Berlin by Hans Fallada. And that is translated from German. So that is set in the Second World War. It's set in about like 1940, just after the fall of France. There's a family of Nazis in the apartment building who are celebrating that France has surrendered and they now occupy France in like the first chapter. So it's described as a book about a man whose son is killed at the front, and then he starts like a quiet resistance against the Nazi regime. But I think that sort of underplays the book a little bit. So you're sort of within the first couple of chapters introduced to various families living in a particular apartment block, that family being one who's lost a son, being one of them. There's a family of Nazis. I keep saying that, but like they literally make a point of the fact that two of the sons are in the SS. Like they're very in the party, very ambitious party members. And then there's like a retired judge and there's this other sort of like, so there's a couple that you sort of introduced to this, and it's more
interesting
about
like concept for the novels, like all these kinds of people who have different relationships to the war, like living so close to each other, like that would have been.
And it's, you know, very much about like what individual people are sort of doing and how certain individual people are resisting certain things. I think where I'm up to now, I'm like about halfway through, and the whole idea of this like resistance stuff, we're introduced to a Gestapo officer who is hunting down the person who is leaving these postcards. And this is the quiet resistance that this man Otto is doing. He's leaving postcards basically just saying like, don't support the Führer, you know, war, he's going to kill your sons as well. Basically just writing anti-government messages and dropping them in places. But such is the sort of fascist state that that obviously is like could end his life if he's caught. So basically the blurb sort of describes this cat and mouse game between the Gestapo officer and the resistance. And so we do switch perspectives a lot. I wasn't expecting to be so engaged in this book, but I think it's the switches in perspectives. It's the fact that it's about a lot more than just this one family. And I really think you start to understand different elements of life under the Nazi regime. It's just brilliant. And I can see why, obviously, it's a modern classic. But it also, I'm always a bit nervous about translated fiction. And so I think I'm like really happy that I'm reading something translated and really enjoying it.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm.
So, I know it's hard sometimes because you have to, I mean, with all translated fiction, you have to imagine that whoever has translated it and like, you know, it's obviously reviewed and edited and read and everything just to make sure that it's true to what was intended. But like, things can change and I don't know, it's a strange thing that it's like, and because it seems strange, I think we all can be a little bit resistant to it sometimes, but as you said, it's fine actually. Like,
it's
really
been
translated to make accessible to more people, so we should
and
take advantage.
It's just a beautiful book. I mean, I feel like a bit basic recommending modern classics that other people probably listening to this being like, yeah, we all read that ages ago. But it is, if you are interested in like war fiction, historical fiction, like good historical, I mean, it's funny, isn't it, calling it historical fiction, because it's not, it was written at the time, but it's set, you know, it's hard to know.
It's historical now.
It's historical now, but it was written at the time. So I always think that's interesting. But if you are interested in that period or like mid-20th century writing, I think it's a beautiful example of that. And obviously just a really fascinating insight into a different aspect of the war. We know that I love a Homefront Britain World War II story, but I'm really finding it interesting to read about daily life in Germany in the early 1940s, like what was that actually like for a lot of people? How were they, you know, either agreeing with or having their own little stands against what was happening? It's really a great book, and I was surprised by how like easy it is to sort of read. I think it's just intimidated and expecting a bit different. Really enjoying it.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you enjoyed both of them, but I'm glad you kind of thought of something and sought out books in like this particular area to read because you were going there and interested in these things when you wouldn't have otherwise.
I wouldn't have read them otherwise.
It's not like they were already sitting waiting on your shelf, you know?
Exactly.
So I think that's really good.
Speaking of as well, shall I tell you what I bought there? Because I bought, obviously, German fiction.
Of course.
There. Well, as a I'm a crazy bookish person collector, I bought myself a German copy of The Thursday Murder Club because I thought I would like to find different editions, and it's a series that has been translated into a lot of different languages. You sort of need something that you know you're going to find in different places. So it is Der Donnerstags Mordklub. It's quite cute. It's still got the fox on the cover and stuff. The fox is like an important part of the cover design for all of that series. So that's really cool. I was attracted to a table that said books set in Berlin. So I bought a book called The Berliners by Emma Harding. And this is, says, Willkommen, welcome to Friedrichstrasse 19, Berlin, an imposing house in a street on the front line of history. Over the course of the 20th century, it has been home to visionaries, cabaret singers, love-struck strangers, teenage runaways, pornographic photographers, and reluctant terrorists. In this exhilarating novel, six people seek to change their lives as the city remakes itself around them. The house on Friedrichstrasse witnesses innovation and radicalism, love and war, in a city with so much history. Is it ever possible to outrun the past? Time travelling through the decades, these extraordinary lives show that while a city changes, everyone leaves a trace. And it's a debut, so I'm interested to read that. And then the other one was one of the recommendations I got from the bookseller, because that's a bookseller's favourite thing to do. And it is called Marzahn Mon Amour, and it is by Katja Oskamp, translated by Joe Heinrich, so another translation. A woman approaching the invisible years of middle age abandons her failing writing career to retrain as a chiropodist in the East Berlin suburb of Marzahn, once the GDR's largest prefabricated housing estate. From her intimate vantage point at the foot of the clinic chair, she observes her clients and co-workers listening to their stories with empathy and curiosity. Part memoir, part collective history, Katja Oskamp's love letter to the inhabitants of Marzahn is a tender reflection on life's progression and our ability to forge connections in the unlikeliest of places. Each client's story stands alone as a beautifully crafted vignette, but together they form a portrait of a community. So again, a little bit out of my usual, it's like a little bit different from my usual reading, but you know, love a bookseller recommendation, and it's always good to, I think kind of push. I think this is the year, if anything, of reading. This is the year of like pushing my boundaries a little bit with what I read, and I'm really enjoying it so far.
Great. I love that.
So I have talked and talked and talked and talked. It's been a very me-heavy episode.
That's okay. No, that's okay, because Michelle, dear listeners, I have nothing to say. I messaged Michelle at like a couple of days ago when we were planning this recording, and I was like, I have been reading, you know, like a big important book for work that I can't talk about. It's a bit secret. It's not the right time for me to talk about this book. And we had a really busy week at work with HarperCollins Literary Bites this past week, which is a big event in our office with a bunch of different booksellers, which Michelle was like, I was seeing on everyone's stories. I was so jealous.
I want to go to a bookseller event.
So it was very fun, and that was great. So yeah, it's just been a busy time, and I was like, I don't really have anything to recommend. And I was like, and you have a lot to say, so this is actually great timing. And all of this has been so nice to hear about your trip more and about different books you're reading and everything. And we now can move into our interview with the wonderful Bridie about a different Australian living in the UK.
Our guest today is an Australian TV writer who has written shows for the likes of Netflix, Apple TV, and Disney. In a former life, she was a cabaret performer, kids' party entertainer, and sex columnist. Today, though, we are chatting about her debut novel, Go Lightly. Welcome to Better Words, Bridie Lee Kennedy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited to chat about this book. I feel like there's so many little interesting things that I want to talk about. So first up, you should probably just tell us a bit about Go Lightly.
I'm terrible at this bit. So Go Lightly is about Ada. She's the main character. She's an Australian living in London, and she's kind of working as a cabaret performer, mostly working as a temp. And she basically meets two people at the same time, Stuart and Sadie, both of whom she decides to pursue a relationship with. And yeah, so it, I guess from that pitch, it kind of reads like, it sounds like a love triangle, but a lot of the most important relationships in the book are between Ada and her friends. And then also there's a section where she goes and spends time with her family over in Florida. So I think it's sort of just about different kinds of love. And Ada herself is pretty confident and pretty like she's not kind of meek and mild at all as a protagonist, but I do think that you see through the book the different ways that she kind of performs herself for different people. I was told in another interview that it's about rejecting conformity. I didn't know that. They were like, why did you find that important to write about? I was like, that's fascinating. What else is the book about?
Tell me more.
I think it also is like a little bit about kind of the idea of like main character syndrome. Like Ada definitely views herself as like the protagonist of life, and that can be fine, but it can also kind of mean that you're accidentally missing other important things happening. Yes. Is that a summary?
Yeah, it is a little bit hard to describe in some ways, so I can maybe see why you're struggling with that, and maybe we'll see what else we can tell you about this book.
It's always hard with a character novel, isn't it? Because so much of it is internal conflicts, so it's hard to sort of sum it up. So, yeah.
I mean, we joke all the time that our favourite books, people could ask us, like, oh, what are you reading? Like, what's it about? And we go, it's like a person and their life and they like meet someone and but also there's this stuff with their job and also this stuff with their family, and we're just like, what even is it about? It's about someone.
Just tell us what, you know, we're also obsessing over in our own lives. We'll just explore that, you know. So you mentioned obviously that Ada is a living abroad. Obviously, people who listen to this podcast regularly know that I'm living abroad. it kind of seems like her experiences, you know, like at Edinburgh Fringe, being a performer, some of those sorts of elements might have been influenced by your own as well. And I understand you met your partner overseas as well. So it is a common experience for Aussies. It is like the classic thing. And, you know, to be fair, for Brits going to the UK for a couple of years as well. Like it is the swap sort of thing that happens is so common. Basically, I mean, you will not have a definitive answer to this, of course, but why do you think that it's not shown more in books and TV, considering it seems to be something that is such a normalized, it's almost like the gap year or the school year experience on the list of things that young people in Australia want to do?
I actually do have a couple of theories about this.
Oh, yay.
Great.
As I was asking it, I was like, you're asking you a very big question here. Like, tell us why.
I know. But I just started thinking about it, reading this book, because I was like, I know so many people, Michelle included, who have done this.
Yeah.
And I can't really think of another book or a TV show I've seen or movie I've seen or anything like that is about this. So please tell us your theories.
I mean, I have a practical answer to the TV question, which is that British production companies aren't particularly interested in paying for a story about an Australian. So it would either be that an Australian production company would have to pay to film in the UK. Flush Australian production company.
Yeah. So logistically, there's some issues there for sure.
Yeah, and like definitely when I started out working in TV, everyone always has like a bunch of pilots that you use for trying to get jobs. And one of mine actually was about an Australian in the UK, a very different vibe to the book. That pilot got me jobs in that people were like, oh, we like the writing in this. But like there was never a suggestion like, oh, we would put this on the BBC about this like Australian living in the UK. But I think also on like a, this is my like soapbox about the move to the UK thing. So my parents did it in like the 70s. They like lived overseas for like 4 years or something, and they worked in the UK, and it was like really common then as well. And like they were friends with the whole like the Oz crowd, which is Candlelist newspaper over there, and it was like a bunch of hippie Australians all moved there, and they could kind of afford to, like they could work, they could make artists' lives in the UK work. And then I think that stayed true for a while. And then I moved to the UK in 2012. And I would say even in the time since then, so I was like my like early 20s, and I was like, yeah, like just moved to the UK, whatever. Let's see what I can make stick. And I kind of think that even in the time since 2012, it has become harder and harder to live in the UK without a good job, basically. Mm. So that idea of artists just going kicking around there, it like is kind of hard to make it work now. So like when I moved over there, I would say like six of us who all went to Sydney Uni together, we all moved over within a year of each other. I had the fewest plans of anyone and the fewest job opportunities, but three of them moved over to go to drama school, and two of them moved over to do sort of broadly like music and like audio production and stuff like that. And I moved over being like, I don't know, I'm gonna like write sketch shows or maybe,
yeah,
who
let's
knows.
Let's see.
It got increasingly hard for everyone. And now, like, if there was someone coming out of university even now being like, oh, maybe I'll just go and like be sporadically employed in London for a bit, I'm like, I actually would not recommend you do that unless you are independently wealthy.
My advice is if you are single and wanting to do that, go for like a gap year au pair thing. You will get paid well. You won't have to pay the extortionate bills that the rest of us do. And you will probably live somewhere very, very, very nice that you could only dream of otherwise in the UK. So be an au pair.
That's a great
one of the like 15 jobs that I did when I moved to London was I was nannying, but I wasn't like an in-home nanny. But I look back at my schedule in those first couple of years and like what I was trying to do in order to live there, which was basically like I would either temp or do hospitality jobs in the day, or I would have nannying like 3 days a week. Then in the evenings, I was like working as an usher in a theater, and I worked in a bar, and I was trying to like make live performance things on the side. So if I wasn't working at night, I was like gigging. And I, you know, I couldn't keep up that pace now. But I also think like, even with all of that, you know, minimum wage in London is like, it's, you know, it's not living wage. And that's, it's really, it's like, I'm so sorry I started this out on such a bum note, but like, it kind of does bum me out. Like I know a couple of people like in their early 20s, who have moved over recently, but one of them is a teacher and two of them are lawyers. And I'm like, yeah, you've moved with like jobs. And I'm like always advocating like people work way less. I'm not like a hustle culture person, and London is very like, you got to be a hustle culture person if you want to come over.
I guess it's like personal choice and stuff, and London has a lot of appeal. But yeah, there are definitely ways to do it.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because it's a very different thing to move overseas and, you know, like, and many other new experiences, but have, say, a slightly more normal 9-to-5 job, for example, if you're a lawyer or something, because that's very different to the, like, ooh, like, kick around and, you know, work in bars and travel and, like, that kind of post-uni, don't get a real job, 2-year working visa thing that it, like, that it used to be.
Yeah.
That people would do. So it is,
it's a shame.
Like, technically you're still doing it, but it's actually you're doing a different thing, which is why it's interesting to talk about as well, because it's the whole nature of it is changing because life is very expensive.
I would have said people from, you know, where we're from, regional Queensland and stuff, would have done the same thing, you know, of like, well, I'm going to move to Melbourne, don't really have any plans. I'm going to move to Sydney, don't really have any plans. We'll just see what... And none of us can do that. That opportunity is gone now for a lot of people, which is really sad. We're starting this on a very sad note.
I think it's important because, like, so my partner and I are both TV writers, we definitely, you know, had like good work coming out of the UK, but we actually a few years ago started doing a lot of work with American producers and American production companies, some of it remote. Sometimes we had to go to LA to do that work. And we actually were due to move to LA for a job I had in mid-2020. did not move.
Wonder what happened then.
Yeah, I just decided not to for some reason. I think one of the reasons, this is like my other little soapbox, that like there is still more of career advancement in America than particularly the UK is because of the strength of the unions. And so if you are in a union show, and you should not be writing in Hollywood if you're not in a union show, if you're in a union show, like I did one, it's just like an example, but I did one for Apple TV last year, anyway, we had like a 20-week writer's room. The UK will never, production companies will never fund a 20-week writer's room. Like, that's just for number one. Australian producers are actually in some ways better about the writer's room concept. I'm sorry if this is really boring, by the way.
No, it's fascinating. This is why I listen to a podcast about it too. I love the inside stuff. We know a bit about the book writing world. We consume a lot of TV. It's fascinating to hear about it.
Yeah.
Well, so basically in this, like, just to use this room as an this particular room as an example for the Apple show, within that room, which was remote, we had a writer's assistant there on union scale. So that is your first job. If you're trying to be a TV writer, you are sending your script out, you will get hired as a writer's assistant. That means you will spend 20 weeks sitting in that room. You will take notes. It's your job to distribute material to everyone. If you're in person, it's your job to take lunch orders. It's all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
However, if you have a good showrunner, you are also asked your opinion on like episode things, plot points. You might even, depending on the length of the show, get to co-write or like have a story by credit on a script. But a lot of what you're doing is like the shit kicking work. The idea is if you have been a writer's assistant, you will then move up to a junior writer. Again, you've got a union minimum if you're working as a junior writer. Then you've got staff writer. Then you've got story editor, executive. It goes up like that. So often you'll see, like, you know, for example, there's some shows where I actually have been a story editor. There's some that I'm listed as story editor because that is the deal that we negotiated, and it means I get a higher minimum for my work. But basically, because of all that, and that's why, you know, the unions went on strike and they worked really hard, because they see what's happening in other industries. They see what's happening in other countries, and they see the threat of AI. And I think it's just, it's so important that those roles are protected. So, you know, my partner and I did talk a lot about moving to LA more permanently because we were going back and forth for a while. But actually, we basically made the lifestyle decision instead of the correct financial decision.
I mean, I also support that.
Yeah, we had that kind of, you know, that sort of thing that I think happened to a lot of people during COVID, which was like, yeah. Are we making decisions based on what makes us happy, or are we making decisions based on chasing some sort of amorphous idea of what our careers could be? And it has been easier because people are, you know, remote now. People are much more open to you not actually physically being there.
Yeah, totally.
Obviously, one of the big themes of the book, I say obviously, but maybe I'm going to say this and you're going to be like, oh. I think you said this as well, is the way that Ada presents herself and is sort of has that different version of herself with different people, which is incredibly relatable. And I actually said, like, why did you want to explore this with a bit of like a bi love triangle? But it's not really a love triangle, like you said, but you've got those two people and you've got this situation. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think because she is with two people who are like different genders, you can think of it like, oh, this is how she performs in a relationship with a woman. This is how she performs in a relationship with a man, like whatever. But I don't really think it's that. I don't think it is necessarily gendered in that way so much as every relationship that you have with someone, you have a relationship with them as a specific version of yourself. And I think I kind of wanted to show that also with when she spends time with her family, she's a different version again. And, you know, there can be like, she's got this best friend Mel, and it's like maybe when she's with Mel, that's who she most authentically is. But there's no reason to think that the other versions aren't equally authentic. They're just, you know, like I wrote this book having, it's funny, like Ada and I think share some biographical detail, but we don't, personality wise, we're not really close together. But I do wonder if part of that is that I think she's so in her 20s, like she's so like that time when you are figuring yourself out, you know, she's probably going through her Saturn returns. I'm like not an astrology girly at all, but I like really believe in Saturn returns. It's the only thing I believe in. You know, she's going through all this stuff in her life where like the thing about Ada is she doesn't exactly know who she is, but she's quite confident with each version of herself, I guess. And I think, and then, you know,
it's kind of like all these forces around her are like muddling through it all isn't quite enough anymore.
And I think that part of it is like I was thinking about like queerness, in that there is this, you know, Ada's bi and so am I, but like the idea of bisexuality as a label, like it doesn't really encompass everything about her necessarily, just as I've never felt it encompasses everything about me. And that's why I think like the relationships that she has with Stuart and Sadie, I wanted to kind of stand on their own as like just realistic kind of relationships, rather than being like, you know, she and Sadie talk about their queerness, which is like, yeah, if you're a queer woman and you're dating another queer woman, you're going to talk about like your queerness eventually. But it's kind of like it's not that interesting to Ada. Like she doesn't have doubt about it, but she's also not like, she doesn't like talk about it as a part of her. Like she tells Stuart in like a throwaway line because it's just like not. It's
not.
I think introspection isn't very interesting to her, and that includes when it comes to her sexuality.
Yeah, it is really interesting because I think while maybe we were writing these questions, and I was like, it is an interesting thing how different she is with Sadie and Stuart, but it's for many reasons. In some ways, I was almost more interested in how with Sadie, they're both Australian, and then the difference with Stuart is that he's English, and some of those like cultural differences and references and things like that were, that was almost more interesting to me, I think.
Yeah, and I think there is, I moved to the UK single. I really went through the dating trenches there, and I've got to say there is something unique about the experience as an Australian of like dating British people. There is like it feels different, and it there is a level of immediate sort of knowledge about each other that you have a bit if you are not only Australians, but they're both Australians who are working in the arts, who are over in the UK at the same time. Like they have all of this common ground
and experiences. Yeah, shorthand. It's exactly the right word.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she and Stuart don't really have any crossover in that sense. So it is a bit hard.
No, they don't. And it is fascinating, I think, about even you saying about your experience as an Australian dating British people, because I feel like, every couple of weeks I feel like I see some kind of clickbait headline, some TikTok video that's gone viral of some American or English person here being like, dating in Australia sucks, why are you all so bad at this? I'm like, oh no, why, what are we doing anyway?
Well, Americans talking about dating in Australia, they're like, everyone's like so like casual about it, and like no one's I've seen the same TikToks where they've been like, oh yeah, and they're just like kind of make like it's like they don't really understand the kind of vibe of like you do kind of make fun of each other and like take this out of each other, and so they're a bit like, everyone's really mean, and I'm like, oh
honey, and I think almost like I haven't been to America, but I do think that the sense of humor translates better in the UK, like when you are it's the, if I take the piss out of you, it's because I like you as a person, whether that's friends, colleagues, whatever, like that sort of gentle ribbing becomes part of what we do and part of our relationships. Whereas in America, I think it's a little bit more, like a little bit more serious and a little bit more, there's not the same level of banter, for lack of a better word.
And also like, if you're having trouble with this in Australia, you should not go to New Zealand. It will be worse for you.
Oh man, there's so much even on this topic. But on the dating topic still, the other thing that I found so fascinating, and there's different lines I was just like loving, is that there are so many things with Stuart and Sadie. So obviously we've said Sadie is female, Stuart is male. Sadie is Australian and works in the arts. Stuart is British, and I forget what he does for a job. Anyway.
He's like just working in a... got a job in a cafe. He doesn't
a cafe
really have,
that's right yeah
because he's really things, cause he's younger as well, so
he is younger, which I kind of thought might like not explain some of the differences between them, but like Sadie is older, he's younger, so like you do kind of have maybe fewer expectations on a relationship with a younger person as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like just finished university.
Yeah. Yeah. There's things there anyway. also, the distance and digital aspect. So for quite soon in this novel, Sadie and Ada are spending a lot of time together, and Sadie's staying with Ada and Mel, and Stuart lives in Liverpool further away, and they're communicating, like texting, some calls and things like that. And that digital romance element is even though it's all been around for quite some time, it still feels like so modern and so fresh, and it's so relatable because we all do that. But I absolutely loved the line. I've got it written down here so I can read it back to you. They messaged each other for 13 days and he had cut her off for 3, and those numbers shouldn't have hurt the way they did. It's kind of early on, as they're sort of, you know, they've been messaging and like, you know, what's the point of messaging someone if you're not going to meet up with them, and that kind of stuff's been going on. Yeah. But that, oh, we've been talking for 2 weeks and then he didn't talk to me for a couple of days, and why does that hurt so much, is I'm sure everyone has had that exact experience. I know I have. And also including text messages throughout the book as well. Can you tell us a little bit about writing some of the digital elements of this story?
Yeah, to be honest, I was like a bit worried it was going to be alienating, or like people wouldn't enjoy those bits that much. I was kind of relieved when like the book went to auction, people were like were saying that was like something they did enjoy, because it was like, yeah, definitely the bit of the book I was probably the most anxious about. But I think it's just, I don't know how to tell a story about two people getting together now without talking about the ways they interact when they're not physically together. So like, I obviously was, you know, I lived away from home for a really long time, so a lot of my friendships moved online. And then also I, when I was like doing cabaret, and then also when I was a kids party entertainer and all sorts of things, I was like touring around a lot. And so I met people, and sometimes people that I would then go on to like have romantic things with in different cities. And I think that there's the way, like there's just very few couples now who meet in person, or they say they and Ada do, but then their entire relationship, like you're still going to be texting, like you're still, you're going to be in touch when you're not physically together, in ways that are probably not great sometimes for developing relationships. But yeah, I guess I just didn't really know how to tell the story about people getting together without including that. And I think one of the points of difference between Sadie and Stuart as well is the frequency of messaging. You know, Sadie's not a texter, and she's not getting in touch all the time when they're not physically together, except to ask. When she gets in touch, it's to ask practical questions like, do you want me to pick something up for dinner, you know? And whereas Stuart is like, let's live my whole life in my phone kind of vibe. And I think that is also, it's two different ways of having relationships, and also is kind of related to their age probably.
And also I wonder too, is it also a little bit related to the fact that, as Caitlin said it, you know, quite quickly Sadie is staying with Mel and Ada, so they've almost like sort of moved in together a little bit. And I would say that sort of practical stuff is where your relationships moves to when you have moved in with someone and you are spending that quality, sounds so lame, quality time together, you know, because you're having those conversations, you know, before you fall asleep, or, you know, when you wake up in the morning, or, you know, over breakfast or whatever, you've got that time together physically where you are doing things that you would otherwise, when you're alone and when you first start dating someone and you're not together all the time, even if you live in the same town, you are texting, you are being like, how was your day? What were you doing? Like that's, I do that with my friends now, but then my husband, it's like, can you please get milk on your way home? Cool. Thanks.
I do think as well that texting creates a sort of false intimacy, particularly
100%
relationships. Like Sadie and Ada are together a lot more in the book, but I do think that in a lot of ways Ada talks more deliberately about herself to Stuart, and he talks deliberately about himself to her, because if you're texting, you don't have, like, you know, I think about like if you're hanging out with someone all the time, you can get a read on their mood immediately, like through kind of face-to-face communication. But if all you have is texting, I think you can try and force intimacy by like revealing so much about yourself. And I definitely did that, like when I was, you know, and like internet dating and stuff, it was like, ooh, that's what the profile's about. It's supposed to give this like snapshot of your life, which is kind of impossible, because being like, oh, you know, my biggest ick is like not wearing deodorant doesn't really tell you like, oh, this is a person who, you know, laughs in sad movies or whatever, like because they're uncomfortable. Like that's kind of the that's like the meat of intimacy that is harder to have when you're far apart. And I think it can be hard for people as well, like if they're in relationships that then become long distance relationships.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the conflict then comes from like you don't have that meat of it happening every day.
Yeah, these characters are just so interesting. And the other characters I want to talk about is Ada's family. So you mentioned before as well that there's a section of the book where she goes and visits Florida and spends some time with her sister, her new brother-in-law, and her parents are also there because her sister's having a baby. And that section of the book was just, I found it so delightful to read. I loved reading about all the family being back together and those funny things about like when you get back with your parents and like her mum is like, oh, do you want a little snack in the in the car? And she's like, yes, please. Even though she's like a fully grown adult, like those little things are so nice and so realistic. And I love those things. I loved that. I also loved reading about how she felt at home in Florida because that's how I felt. I only went to like Disney World, but we grew up in regional Queensland. And so I was there with a friend and we were like, it's hot here. It feels exactly like home.
Yeah. I mean, I
also,
I
politically speaking, probably not that far off from where we grew up, Caitlin.
Yeah. I mean, I will say the book is set like a couple of years ago and Florida has taken some turns since then. Not that it was like amazing at the time. When I went to Florida, like Obama was president, so things have like kind of progressed in some interesting ways. I mean, I think that part of that section was I have brothers, I don't have sisters, and I find I have always, and like not to be like gross and gender essentialist about it, but like I have always found like sisters' relationships with each other very interesting, possibly because I don't have one. But like I do think that there is kind of a weight to certain sister relationships, and I think they show up much more commonly in fiction than like brother relationships or even like mixed gender relationships, sibling relationships. And so I kind of wanted to write this pair of sisters, and also just draw on the fact like I had, you know, lived overseas for so long, and when I would come home, I did have to like relearn how to be within my family, and we're like a pretty close family as well. But it was like, I've got these two older brothers, and like, when I moved to the UK, I was like, you know, recently out of uni, and I like was this was still kind of not like a teenager, but like in that early 20s like phase, more chaotic phase. And by the time I moved back, I like, you know, had a partner and a job, and like you've got to relearn how to balance in each other's lives. And so I've always found that kind of interesting. But the relationship between the sisters was something I really enjoyed writing and digging into. Also, I've been so surprised by how many people I've spoken to who have talked to me about Hank, which is the sister's husband, who he was supposed to be, this is like a maybe weird bit of the writing process that I assume happens to other writers. Hank was definitely not supposed to be such a focus of the trip to Florida, but as I was writing him, I like became extremely fond of Hank. And would, like, I started just like increasing the time that he took up in that section. And I do think, you know, if your siblings have partners, especially if they then have kids, those people are going to be in your life forever. And the way you relate to them is very important. I just like ended up like in some ways Hank is, I think Ada thinks of Hank as like this really uncomplicated person, and I think her dropping some of her prejudices to kind of like get to know him a little more deeply was something I really enjoyed writing, as I kind of got to know Hank a little more deeply through the course of writing him.
Yeah, and I think you experience that as the reader too, because
those
first couple of emails, you're like, okay, like I don't know, my like my Australian like radar was up. I was like, okay, you seem like a bit of a wanker, but okay. You sort of this, do. Like, you sort of do American, come to love him.
Conform to him.
So formal,
which I think. which I think is lovely, and I think it is. I would say it's also really realistic and very in line with everything else in this novel writing. Like, don't be concerned, because he's a brand new person that doesn't know her. So how she, you know,
and with they all live away from each
how
other.
She is so you with don't all different versions, like different versions of herself with different people. He's like a completely brand new person that, you know, she's can be a bit different with, but also she's like cautious of him because of her relationship with her sister and, you know, for all of these other different reasons. And it's fascinating. But yeah, I think your siblings, partners, it's a fascinating thing because you've kind of got to be like, well, I guess like I have to like you. And then you're like, oh no, like you're cool, or, you know, hopefully like you all get along hopefully. And everything.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting dynamic, in-laws.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think to coming back to like talking about Ada realizing like all the different ways Ada performs, I think, you know, there's moments, especially on that trip, for Ada to realize that, you know, everyone else, especially her sister, is sort of in that situation too, where she's recognizing that maybe her relationship with her sister is not always like, that's not her sister's whole personality. You know, her sister can be a different person towards Hank, a different person as a mum, you know, that she starts to see this different side of her, and almost like that sort of the way you describe, I guess, her body softening after childbirth is almost like their relationship as well. Like she's like, oh, I can see this like hard edges of this person who I thought I knew sort of soften a little bit. And yeah, it sort of is, I feel like I'm telling you like as if I'm like in a, you know, high school essay. Like it's a great use of metaphor and, you know, but it is. It's
I know.
Like
that, I also feel like we're a bit like, you know, do you know this part of the book?
Well, I mean, I think the stuff about bodies is like, it was something I was conscious of because Ada is someone who lives very much in her body. Like she does not live up in her head that she does a bit, but like not that much. Ada is someone who like she's about experiences and sensations and she's very in her body, and I think part of the conflict between them in the past was a little bit more like you get these flashbacks of Gabby as the kind of like brooding teenager and whatever. Maybe and she, yeah. Ada was like anyway, off to the beach with my friends, and Gabby was like, I'm gonna think dark thoughts. And
I love the bit where she's like, I think I might have a boyfriend, and she's like, oh, that's cool, now get out of my room.
Yeah. And like, I think that part of their difference was just the amount of time they spent in their heads versus their bodies, which is something I'm like really interested in for different people. And I think Gabby, after childbirth, is forced to exist in this body, basically, to like, she's feeding her baby all the time. And Ada's like uncomfortable that like Gabby's boob is out, and she's like, no one's talking about it. But it's like, Gabby is suddenly forced into her body in a way that kind of makes her like Ada. I thought a lot about just the ways they're similar, the ways they're different. Ada mistakes a picture of Gabby for her, a picture of herself for Gabby at one point, and that's kind of, yeah, like you do sort of think maybe to the outside world these two seem really more similar than they see themselves as.
Yeah, probably. I think that's a pretty classic thing in families, is you always go like, oh my God, we're so different. And everyone else is like, okay.
You're really
sure.
Similar.
Like, yeah. Like, oh my God, we're so different. We don't get along. And it's like, actually, you don't get along because you're the same.
Yeah.
So obviously we've talked a bit about screenwriting a little bit earlier. Was there ever a thought that the story for Go Lightly should be a script rather than a novel, or was it always very clearly going to be a novel?
This story I think was always going to be a novel. I had no, until I started writing Go Lightly, I never thought I was going to write a book, a novel. I met my like literary agent in the UK because I used to do this like night that was like people would get up and tell like true stories from their life, but rather than being comedians, it was all writers. So it was kind of like this fun like salon vibe. And ooh, my literary agent, it was so good. It was run by this writer who's like pen name is Kit Lovelace, who's incredible. And he really, like, the people who I met doing that years ago, so many of us now have books out. It's like great. Like Ella Risbridger did it, Carolina Donahue, Monica Heisey, like all of these people who have books out. We all used to do this same thing called Romantic Misadventure.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. And at the time, all of us were like, we were not writing books at the time. A lot of people were working for like BuzzFeed or Vice, RIP. And then like I was like temping and trying to be like, I don't know, a comedian, but not really. Mostly I was like had no idea what I was doing. But sometimes like literary agents and stuff would come along. And I met my agent there, and I thought I would write a book of essays. That's what I thought I was going to do. I was like, I'll keep making money as a screenwriter once I started making money as a screenwriter, which was the first time I'd made any money as an adult. So I was like, got to keep doing this. And then, I was like, oh, I'll write a book of essays. And my agent was like, yeah, no one really wants to buy a book of essays from someone they've never heard of. And I was like, yeah, but what if they're really good? And she was like, are they? And I was like, so I like would write essays and send them to her, and she would be like, yeah, this is fine. Like,
I told you it won't sell though.
And she always said to me, like, you should write fiction. And basically what happened is I ignored her for a long time, and I like focused on my TV writing career. And then in 2020, I had some downtime between TV contracts. I think it was only like a couple of weeks at the time. But obviously I wasn't going anywhere. I did like storytelling shows in Edinburgh, and I had this story in one of my shows that had always like hit pretty well. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll make this an essay for this like book of essays that no one wants. Even my own agent, who is like a wonderful genius and was very polite about it, but was clearly like, what are you doing? And I picked it up, and then I was like, like when it's not performed, I don't know if this will work. And then I was like, why don't I fictionalize it? And so I basically started fictionalizing it and changed a bunch of stuff. And basically that became the first chapter of the book. So it was sort of a writing exercise. And then I was like, wonder what happens if I follow this character. So pretty quickly, because I changed a bunch of stuff, Ada was the thing that stuck out to me that I was like, I think I could tell a story about this person. Sadie obviously was in it right from the start too. So I basically just started writing it, and I was lucky that I had this couple of weeks to just be like, oh, mate, let's see how I go. And then I got to like 15,000 words, and I was like, what am I doing? I can't write a novel. I Googled like novel word count average and was like, but like 80,000 words? Like, that's insane.
Yeah, they're long.
Like, I was like, I don't like working. What am I doing? But I basically sent like 15,000 words to my agent, and I said, I've written the start of a novel, I think. If you think it's like not good or whatever, like I want you to be totally honest, because I will not finish it. Cause I was like, I kind of lost confidence at that point.
Yeah.
And basically my agent wrote back and was like, I want you to finish this novel. Yeah. And I just started writing it. And as I did, I realized that all that time writing storytelling shows and stuff, which was prose rather than screenwriting, had sort of prepped me in a sense. And I started finding that I loved the process. I really thought I wouldn't. I think I'd always been like, I can't write a novel because it seems like hard work. And I did not become a writer to work hard. But I ended up finding that I did feel immersed in the world in a way that sometimes I don't always when screenwriting. And I think part of it is the act of writing prose as opposed to dialogue and action. Some people, like my partner is also a screenwriter, and the ability for him to sit down with a script and just like go, you know, like he's like bam, 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 bam. Whereas for me, screenwriting was always stop, start, stop, start. And I found the flow of prose writing really refreshing after that. And I ended up just loving the process of writing it, and I was like, could I be a novelist? And then I was like, if no one buys this book, no, because I can't afford to like not do my other work. And
yeah.
So if this book hadn't sold, it would have been a long time before I tried to write a new one, I think. So I think Ada was always meant to be in a book.
It's interesting what you say about the flow and like how it started. Yeah, as almost as that performance piece that you like changed and everything, because it is so like the whole novel is so in her head and her internal monologue and everything. And in that way, you kind of read it and think, well, Bridie's a screenwriter. Was this ever a script? How could this ever be a script? Was she writing some script and be like, how will anyone know what this girl actually wants or is thinking? We need to be inside her head. Like, I was like,
Why is this all voiceover?
How did we get here? Yeah. Is the script just voiceover? Because it's so different. And I think maybe I started thinking about that to be like, Go Lightly was a TV series. Like, what would that look like? Because it is so in Ada's head. I feel like that is what is hard about books sometimes, like adaptations, is that you look like outside of the character's perspective.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for any potential producer listening, I think it'd be a breeze to adapt Go Lightly. I think it'd be wild to pass on the opportunity.
Well, you could do it. You're a screenwriter.
Well, so I have an adaptations agent who like handles kind of those conversations, adaptations and translations. And she said to me in this kind of cautious way, in like one of our first meetings, she was like, so you're a screenwriter, like if it was adapted, would you want to write all of it? And I was like, oh no. She's like, no. Okay. She was clearly expecting me to say yes. And I said to her, like, because I'm a screenwriter, I have worked with people with like existing IP, and it is really hard to get them to get out of their own way with it. You know, the kill your darlings thing, you have to kill a bunch of them if you're adapting something. And I said, you know, I would like want a story edit or like write one script or whatever. I was like, there is no way in the world that I would want to adapt Go Lightly myself, because I don't think I would be best placed to do it. Give me someone else's book to adapt. I've done that. Like, I've done those development projects and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I am not the right person to do it. Someone on the outside has to do it, because otherwise I'll just be like, but I feel like Ada would like do this, and they'd be like, it literally doesn't matter. And you've wasted a day of our time on this like thing that doesn't matter. So I'm very, very like,
self-aware, Bridie. That's good.
Yeah, I was just like, oh my God, I can't imagine sitting here and being like, you know, like even the fact that I've like got this random fondness for Hank, who is like not a major character in the book. And I would be like, let's do an episode from Hank's perspective. And they'd be like, no one's asking for that. No one wants that but you.
I mean, we do love Hank, but you're right. If we were watching that series, would we be like, did we need to spend this much time with Hank? It's not about Hank.
Also, people being like, I tuned in for like a queer love story, and we're spending a lot of time with this straight American guy who's not in a relationship with the main character.
Yeah.
They'd be like, I'm pretty sure I was promised queer sex, and there's just a lot of driving around buying chicken with this man. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
What
No, I did love Hank though. Yeah. Wow. So then you already had an agent. You somehow wrote the book. So then what happened? Once you'd finished it, tell us about what happened then.
Well, so the book took me like a little while to write. When I didn't have another contract going, I could really just like focus on the book, and that was great. I'm not someone, I don't work evenings, I don't work weekends. I like did a lot of that when I was like starting out, and I really burnt out. I was really working too hard, and I've made like a lot of lifestyle decisions now that are based on like reducing that kind of energy in my life. And so I was like, I can't really, if I'm working full time on a TV show, I like cannot really be writing the book. But I would always like, you know, find an hour here or there and like do 1,000 words and like whatever. And I like made sure I stayed in the world. And then I got to the start of 2022, I think. So I'd started writing it late 2020, and I knew what the end of the book was going to be, but I had basically like 20,000 words to go. And I was finishing a TV contract, and I had another one coming up in like 3 weeks or nearly a month. And normally I would then go to my TV agent and be like, is there any development work going? But my partner gave me kind of a great gift, which was the time. And he was like, I want you to finish the book. Like, that's what I want you to do at this time. And so in January, I took myself to Hastings for like 5 days alone and stayed in a hotel off season, which is such an experience. I would really recommend anyone living in England do go to a seaside town in the winter. Most of the hotels, so I got this incredible room for like no money, just looking out of the ocean. There was only me and a couple from Essex in the hotel, and they had two big bulldogs who came to breakfast every morning. And most of the hotel was blocked off. So there's like a ballroom, there's like all this stuff. It was all blocked off. There was just a couple of rooms available and the breakfast room. And there was like two people working there. So
That's interesting. Like true off-season,
Caitlin, this is
kind of thing.
Like when we went to Whitby the other day and we got there and I was like, oh, the parking's free. Excellent. Yeah. Like it's free until the start of March. Wonderful.
I feel like nothing's really truly off-season in Australia because it's always bearable.
Yeah, because you don't have the terrible weather.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I was really lucky. The like 5 days I was there, it was really cold. I mean, it was like, you know, 1 to 5 degrees or whatever, but it was clear the whole time I was there, which actually makes being by the ocean like gorgeous.
Yeah.
And,
I made a rule for myself every morning that I couldn't drink coffee in the hotel. So I would have to walk into town to buy a coffee. And while I did that walk, I would think about what I was going to write that day. And basically in that 5 days, I like basically finished the book. I had then edits and tweaks and stuff to do when I came back to London. But I got the big chunk of it done. So my agent read a draft. She'd been reading it in like 15,000 word chunks. So then I wrote another draft based on my agent's notes and my friend's notes. And then after that, Imogen, my agent, was like, okay, I think we can take it out. I did not know what was going to happen. Imogen was like, I mean, you work in book publishing. You know what happens here. I had no idea. What I did get told, though, like, and I had friends who worked in publishing and stuff, they were like, don't expect to hear back straight away, basically. Imogen sent the books out to her list of who she thought would be interested on like a Monday, and on the Tuesday she went on holiday, and then she called me from Barcelona the next day and I was like, oh, it might have been Wednesday morning actually, and she'd sent it out on Monday evening, and I was like, oh, she's gonna tell me that there's like a huge typo in the book, or like I was like, she's calling me from holiday, there's gonna be like bad news. But I was like, surely not everyone has passed already, like they can't have already, like I was like, oh my god.
Oh no. Yeah.
So I picked up the phone and Imogen was like, someone's made an offer on the book, and I was like, which book? Like I genuinely was like,
what do you mean?
For the one I wrote? And she was like, yes, why would I be calling you about another client?
Just dangling that in front of you that this client has had offers on their book.
I was honestly like, what are you talking about? Like, I didn't understand really what would happen. Like, because I'd given myself, I had basically, the book had gone and I had gone, okay, for the first time in like 2 years, I'm not thinking about the book. It's out of my hands now. So I had been like, for 2 weeks, I'm not going to think about the book. I'm like, that's what I'm going to do. And then I'll be like, Imogen, you haven't read the book.
Have you heard anything? Yeah.
Anyway, basically someone made an offer on the book and I was like, oh, okay, so we should take it. And she was like, no. She was like, someone's made an offer this early. I use that to encourage other people to read the book faster. So, I mean, I have to say, and to this day,
that's why you have an agent, right? Like you would just be there being like, yes, I accept. Yes.
I literally was like, call back right now and say yes. She was like, no.
And you said, I will not. Your phone.
So basically she was like, I'm going to tell everyone that an offer has been made. And I kind of feel bad to this day because that editor didn't end up being the one that we went with, but I kind of credit her with getting me to an auction, which was beyond my wildest dreams. And I think it's because someone made an offer early and other editors are like, oh, shit, I got to read this book now. Because if like she takes that offer and then in a week I read it, or 2 weeks or a month, and then want to make an offer, like it's gone by. So one person making an offer basically triggers everyone else to read the book much faster than they otherwise would.
100%.
Yeah. So I didn't know any of that, which is why I was like, just take the offer, Imogen. She could take it off the table at any time. And Imogen was like, she's not going to do that, you lunatic. She was like, I know you haven't sold a book before, but you understand basic negotiation. I was like, I really don't. But yeah, so we went to auction again. I thought auction would be like, bang, bang, sold. We're all in a room together and it's like done. Which actually did, when we ended up selling the American rights, my American agent did like it on one day and was like, best and final, come in at 5 p.m. and that's it.
America's America. Different.
Yeah, but the UK auction took 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And was slowed down because the queen rudely died in the middle of it. So it took like 2 weeks, and then we had like rounds of offers. And then I met with the final three publishers on shows off the back of that. I'm writing a new book at the moment. I have no expectation that any of this is ever going to happen again. I think I thought like, oh, you get one book published, then you just will be confident from then on. Like, I don't feel that way. I don't have the sense. So it might be that having an auction and getting to choose is going to be like the high point of my career. So I don't take it for granted at all. And I also do not take Imogen for granted at all. I think she's like, I obviously, you know, I had to write the book, but none of this would be possible if I didn't have like an amazing agent. Which I think is a real shame, because I think there's amazing novels out there by unsigned writers who are going to have a much harder time. And that's just, you know, how the industry works.
Exactly. But you're right. Like, right, you know, once you've had a book published, there's more that goes into it than just writing the second book and going like, here you go, aren't you grateful? Like, they still have to like read it and buy it, and it still goes to acquisitions. Yeah. And yeah, it's not the immediate yes that people maybe think it could be. And that would be the same for anything. I'm sure it's the same in TV and stuff as well.
Oh yeah, one job never guarantees another one. Unfortunately, would be lovely for my sanity if that was not the way it worked. But
yeah. It is a very funny process. I wonder if maybe as a screenwriter, knowing that TV and stuff can take such a long time as well, because I think maybe the length of the publishing process can surprise people sometimes. Mm. But
I mean, I have found the length kind of hard, because we sold the book in UK. So like, we sold the book in UK autumn 2022, and it will be coming out in UK spring 2024. So like, it is like, that is a big gap, particularly when the book was finished. Like, we did creative edits and then copy edits and stuff, but like, I was kind of shocked by how long it took, and it kind of meant that for long periods of time I didn't feel that I did have a book coming out.
Yeah.
I had to keep being like, no, wait a second, it is happening. Like, you didn't imagine it.
Until you actually see it and hold it.
Yeah, I mean, they announced the book and then I like immediately took a TV job. It has been a long process, which I hope I would be better prepared for next time around, because I did find that kind of weird.
Yeah, and now bringing us all the way around, we are talking to you just before the book comes out, like in stores in Australia and the UK. So how are you feeling now that the book is almost out in the world?
You know, I definitely feel nervous about how it's going to be received. I think I have a lot of anxiety about, no, that's stretching it. I have a lot of concern sometimes about like, you know, I really love like romance books. And like, you know, there's like, you know, your Emily Henrys and like all these kind of amazing people who write these like super fun romance books. And that's not the book that I've written. And I worry sometimes that like people who are looking for a more traditional romance are like not really going to like it. That's my really honest answer of what I worry about. When I wrote it, I didn't actually think about who would be reading it. I think it's kind of important not to obsessively think about who might read the book when you're writing it, because that'll shape it. But now I have to think about it, because now people are going to be reading it. And suddenly that becomes real to me in a way that it hasn't before. So I am stressed about that. I'm looking forward to it being out and kind of the, you know, I'm doing interviews and I've written articles and stuff, like the publicity side of things. And once that kind of dies down, I'll be able to focus on the next book, which I'm enjoying writing so far, but it's like, I do take time off for doing stuff for Go Lightly. And again, this is something like my partner keeps cautioning me against, like thinking about the next book when like I should be celebrating that this is happening now. And I think that's a product of the length of time as well. A friend of mine had his first book come out, James Colley, who's an amazing Australian writer. And he had his first book come out like a few weeks ago, and he posted on Instagram today that he saw it with a library code on it for the first time. And like, that's the kind of thing that I think I'm going to find really exciting. Like, I love the library, and I actually wrote big chunks of the book in various libraries because I work in libraries instead of cafes. And so I think it's stuff like that. Like I can't know now how that's going to feel, but I think it'll be exciting. Even if no one likes it, I'll still get to be in my local library.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure people will like it. We loved it.
People will like it. You've got two right here.
Great. I'll be like, there's two, actually, guys. Yeah. There's two. Yeah.
So that is the perfect place to wrap things up. Thank you so much for joining us today. Just let us know to end on where people can follow you online.
So I'm doing all book stuff on Instagram, which is just at Bridie Lee Kennedy. You know, if you follow on Twitter or X, Bridie LK. But I think other than that, I might just like ghost the internet from here on out. I think it's over.
It's hard.
I'm too old for TikTok and Twitter is dead, so I'm gone.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Instagram's good. We like that. Instagram.
Thank you so much again. It's been great to chat.
Thank you for listening to Better Words. For even more recommendations, you can subscribe to our monthly newsletter on Substack at betterwords.substack.com.
We'd also love to continue the conversation on Instagram, where you can find us at BetterWordsPod.
You can also follow me, Caitlin, at Just a Bookish Babe.
And for more bookish discussions, find me, Michelle, on Substack at theunfinishedbookshelf.substack.com.
Just like with books, podcasts like ours rely on word of mouth recommendations.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a book-loving friend and leave a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it.